It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many of Governor Walker's proposed changes to public assistance in Wisconsin were passed by the legislature this year. We'll talk to the director of a food bank group about how food stamps are being used in the state and how the new regulations could affect people who receive food assistance. First, we take a look at some of the week's biggest stories in national politics. Congress is working toward a federal spending deal that would avert a government shutdown on Friday. Last night's congressional primary election in Illinois put a spotlight on Democratic divisions over abortion rights. And GOP leaders say that Robert Mueller's job is safe after more criticism from the president. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What issues would you like to see resolved in the latest federal spending plan? Do you want to see funding for approval for the DACA program, protection for people here brought here illegally as youth? What about border security, military funding? In Democratic politics, do you want to see moderate Democrats running or people further to the left? Same question for Republicans, moderates, or people further to the right. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Neuhauser is a staff correspondent for the National Journal. He joins us from the U.S. Capitol building. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob. Anytime.
We've had this long series, Daniel, of these last-minute bills to avoid a shutdown or to not avoid a shutdown in some cases. The last one, I thought, was supposed to be a long-term deal, so we wouldn't be back here again and again, but we're back here this week. What happened?
Well, this is basically par for the course now for funding the federal government. We had an unprecedented stretch over the last 5 or 6 months of a continuing resolution, which is basically a short-term bill, you know, just saying let's fund everything at the current levels for about a month. And now, finally, about 6 months late, they're going to do the hard work of funding the government for the current fiscal year, which we're already about halfway through. And that's going to run through about September. And you know, hopefully by then they'll have another deal to do it all over again.
And what are the big issues, the points of contention as we run up to this weekend deadline?
Well, the funny thing about this is it funds all aspects of the federal government. And so whatever is the sort of a top-line fight ends up being things that were just fought about. So we're basically relitigating all the political fights of the last year or so. We've got Obamacare and health care. We've got immigration. We've got guns, veterans, the tax bill that just passed. Almost every one of these things is up in the air because in some cases because Congress was unable to act on them over the last year, and in some cases because they did act, but they acted hastily, like with the tax bill. So they're trying to fix certain things, with that. And I'd be happy to drill down into any one of those categories to talk a little bit more about them.
So it's like those old KTAL albums of the greatest hits of a certain time period. This is Congress's greatest hits of debate lately. One thing that's coming back up, and I do want to dig into some of these, deferred action for childhood arrivals. It keeps being debated. Can we get a deal? People in Congress are saying around this latest funding plan. What's going on with that this time around?
So there is not going to be a deal for the DACA folks in this spending bill. Congress has been talking about taking care of this for a couple of years. They were, famously unable to. So then President Obama created a program with an executive order to essentially shield people who came to the country as young children, as underage children, from deportation, even if they came here without the documents. Now that program is held up in the courts. Trump threatened, to undo that program, but he is unable to right now because the court system has basically said, you don't have a sufficient reason to do this. And so that kind of took the air out of the balloon for Congress to do anything with it. There are no imminent threat of any changes here. There's really no push behind congressional action. And I think that's probably the single biggest contributing factor to things kind of falling apart as far as a deal goes. So they decided to keep that out of the program. I know earlier in the week the White House had offered a 2.5-year extension of the DACA program in exchange for $25 billion in border wall funding. But Democrats turned that down. For them, why should we spend all this money on a border wall that we don't agree with, that we think isn't going to do the job. But even more than that is symbolically, you know, xenophobic, and you know, our base hates it. You know, why should we go along with that until we absolutely have to? For them, there's not an immediate threat of DACA folks being deported, and so we can afford to kind of buy some time on that.
Talking to Daniel Neuhauser from the National Journal about the top stories in national politics. You mentioned that revisiting health care funding and the Affordable Care Act has come up again this week in these negotiations for spending. What are people arguing about this time around?
Well, just like DACA, they decided, well, you know, let's save this issue for another day. So we've got basically premiums are going up on people who are part of the Obamacare exchanges. And so the federal government, you know, there's been talk of making payments to the insurance companies to defray the costs of the premiums. These are called cost-sharing reductions or reinsurance payments. Well, the problem with that is that Republicans, you know, say, why should I vote to fix a bill that I didn't want in the first place and to fund a system that I voted against? So they don't want to do it, but they said, reluctantly, well, we'll do it if we can include protections to make sure that these federal funds don't get spent on plans that fund abortion. And Democrats said, yeah, no way, we're not doing that. So they decided, you know what, let's just scrap the whole thing. This is an issue that we're not going to be able to settle on. There's no middle ground here. So let's just save this one for another day. So that is out of the omnibus, not happening.
There's a lot of that going on, right? A big controversial issue could be resolved, and the omnibus funding bill isn't going to be.
That's exactly it. I mean, unless there is a make-or-break deadline, a lot of things don't get done around here in Congress. There has to be a cliff.
There's one I hadn't seen before. I wasn't familiar with this, trying to fix what's called the grain glitch. What is that, and what's going on?
Well, this is what the problem that I just talked about with Obamacare. This is the opposite problem, but with the tax bill. So basically, in the recently passed tax bill that Republicans passed here in December, and the president signed, it's now the tax law. There was a famously it was done fairly hastily, and so there are going to be some issues in the bill, and this is one where basically it gives exceedingly generous tax benefits to farmers who sell directly to cooperatives rather than corporations. In some cases, their taxes could go down to zero, and that's an issue for farmers who sell to corporations. And so they are trying to fix that. Now, my understanding of the latest is that it is going to get fixed, and that just like Republicans did with the Affordable Care Act when that needed some tweaks, Democrats said, well, you know, this isn't going to come for free. You know, I'm not a sucker. I didn't like this bill in the first place, so I'm not going to help you fix it without a cost. So my understanding is Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer negotiated some increases yet to be determined to the low-income tax credit. So they get to, you know, fund some of their priorities in exchange for fixing this grain glitch.
Big picture, Daniel, is there a sense that all these controversies aside, something is going to get passed and we're not going to have any kind of shutdown?
I think that is the sense, and actually just before coming on, I noticed that the White House said that they would sign the bill, and that, you know, that was kind of up in the air because you don't know where President Trump is going to land on some of these issues. But, you know, everybody knows the deal with these big catch-all bills. It's a bill where, you know, you hold your nose and you vote for it because it's what you need to do to keep the government funded. I mean, it's a $1.3, $1.6 trillion bill. There is going to be something in there that you don't like, no matter where you are on the political spectrum. But the fact is, if you don't pass this kind of bill, then we have a government shutdown, and nobody really wants that. So right now they're in the process of whipping the votes. They can pretty much write off all of the House conservatives and Senate conservatives, and they're just not going to vote for it because they think it spends too much money, and they're not willing to hold their nose and vote yes. I think most of the Democrats will be okay for voting on this, but the big question will be, is somebody like Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, somebody who's shown to be willing to hold up the whole process for one or two issues, are they going to do something and filibuster? We just don't know. I mean, this could pop out of left field at any time, or I guess right field in this case. So let's just see.
Talking to Daniel Neuhauser, staff correspondent for the National Journal in our weekly review of national news. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about this, once again, a government shutdown deadline and a big funding bill? We're going to talk about the primary elections in Illinois, a couple different elections where there was a establishment candidate and somebody challenging from the left for Democrats, from the right for Republicans. What do you want to see in your party? People who are running toward the middle, willing to compromise on issues, or for people further to the left for Democrats, further to the right for Republicans? And should Congress pass a law protecting Robert Mueller from being potentially fired by the president as he goes on with his investigation? Call in on those issues at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation with Daniel Neuhauser of the National Journal, digging into some of the top stories in national politics. Daniel, let's go south of the border from our perspective in Wisconsin. Illinois had their primaries yesterday. And in a congressional race, people were watching. Incumbent Democrat Dave Lipinski nearly defeated a challenger, Marie Newman. Lipinski is an anti-abortion Democrat, kind of a rare breed these days. Can you talk about this race?
Yeah, Dan Lipinski, he is a conservative Democrat. He's the co-chair of the so-called Blue Dog Caucus, which is, they're the conservative wing of the Democratic Party, and really a bit of an endangered breed these days. There used to be a lot of them kicking around, and then when Republicans took over the House, frankly, most of the seats that they won on their way to a majority were these kinds of Democrats. But Lipinski is actually in a pretty safe Democratic seat, and I think that's why someone like Marie Newman ran against him. His dad was a congressman. He comes from an old political family. So you can't say that one issue or another turned this race, but definitely in this case, abortion was a central issue with fundraising groups on either side funding one or the other candidate, and even former aides to President Obama getting involved. It was very, very high profile and really exposed a rift between Democrats, between progressives and more sort of moderate Democrats.
Let's bring on a caller. Dave is with us in Toma. Dave, hi.
Hi.
Well, what did you want to bring up, Dave?
Yeah, I'm awake. I'm barely awake. I like the centrist, as you described, centrist candidates, but there aren't very many. It seems like everybody, when I listen to them too, they're not voting for me, they're not voting for their constituents, they're voting for their party. And I think that's I think the system's become very broken in that respect.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. And Daniel, people are saying this about both parties at the national level. There's less of a mix of moderate Republicans, conservative Democrats, things like that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And since we're talking about Democrats, let's focus on that. I mean, right now they're basically at a bare bones as far as how many seats they can have in Congress. And not surprisingly, a lot of those people who hold these seats end up being, more progressive because they come from more safely Democratic districts where they can, afford to hold more progressive views and still be, still win their seats, but more importantly, still be in keeping with their constituents. But on their road to a majority, they're going to have to go through some of these districts like the one in Illinois or like perhaps the one in Pennsylvania that was just won by Connor Lamb, another Democrat who ran on a more moderate or conservative platform. So there needs to be, if they want to win, it seems, with the current makeup of the House and the way that the districts are drawn, there needs to be, some of these candidates who are going to be able to go into these, Rust Belt districts, or even southern districts, New Mexico, Texas, Virginia, and win over independent voters or even some Republicans now who are disillusioned with Trump but would, probably not vote for a bleeding heart liberal type.
Dave, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. I am a pro-life Democrat, so I often find myself arguing with people. But I want to have at least the Democratic Party have a big tent so people with different views on all kinds of issues can join. But I also want them to fight for things. And I'll see this at both the state and the federal level where all kinds of environmental rules are getting thrown out and pollution would be potentially allowed to run, polluters would be allowed to run rampant. And I see that as hand-in-hand with corruption on both the federal and state level, and I find it appalling. I certainly hope they would work to fight against both those issues.
Nate, thanks for the call. Daniel, Nate's saying Democrats, should be flexible, big tent, but still fight.
Yeah, absolutely. But the question is, fight for what? I mean, you know, you've got a rising progressive wing, and I would say that, you know, a kind of progressivism that we haven't seen in the mainstream of American politics in quite some time. You know, we'll talk about this, I think, a little later in the show, but Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, you know, these are big, you know, big influencers in the Democratic Party. How do you make a party that can, you know, be unified while including the viewpoints of somebody like that and somebody like Dan Lipinski? You know, that's a question that Democrats are going to have to answer, and especially they're going to have to answer if they win back the congressional majorities, as a lot of forecasters think they will.
We are talking to Daniel Neuhauser from the National Journal, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Moving on to another one now. One of President Trump's lawyers called for an end to Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian campaign interference. This after the firing of former FBI Director Andrew McCabe. Trump on Twitter criticizing the probe more. There's been speculation about Mueller's possible firing. GOP leaders were downplaying that. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin.
The special counsel should be free to follow through his investigation to its completion without interference. Absolutely. I am confident that he'll be able to do that. I've received assurances that his firing is not even under consideration. We have a system based upon the rule of law in this country. We have a justice system, and no one is above that justice system.
We've been hearing, Daniel, some Democrats saying, hey, we need a law protecting Robert Mueller from being fired. Republicans saying, don't worry, the White House isn't going to fire him. What are you hearing lately?
Well, I talked to House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy yesterday, and you know, when I asked him what he thinks of these this idea to include something in the spending bill to protect Mueller, he said, you know, that's ridiculous. This is just something being brought up by people who want headlines, and you know, they're trying to make the president look bad. There's no threat, and so Republicans in Congress are walking a fine line here. You know, they don't want to anger the president of their own party, especially, you know, let's say this week when they're going to need his signature on this, on a big must-pass bill. And you know, they've shown, you know, a lot of timidity in the past here trying to cross him, essentially because he is probably the most powerful Republican in the country right now. He has almost completely captured the Republican base, and though he remains unpopular, you know, nationwide, he remains very popular among Republicans. You know, they don't want to do anything that would cross him until it is absolutely necessary. Now, that said, we've seen more and more Republicans saying, well, you know, we don't think he's going to do that. But if he does, then, you know, things are really going to go south. That even Jeff Flake, for instance, said the I word, impeachment. Now, if he were to do that, then that would be grounds for impeachment, Flake said. So, you know, I think they're just trying to tread cautiously, and then if something really does happen, like a Mueller firing, then you know, maybe they'll kick into action.
Let's bring on another caller now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hello. If Congress were to pass something to protect Mr. Mueller, they need the president to sign it. If he doesn't sign it, it can't become a law. The only way out in that situation would be if the president failed to either sign it or veto it. But if he vetoes it, it's the point is moot again.
Tom, thanks for the call. Yeah, they would need potentially a veto-proof majority to pass a law protecting Robert Mueller, Daniel.
Bingo. I mean, somebody's watched their How a Bill Becomes a Law. Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to cobble together in my head a veto-proof majority here, because just so many Republicans wouldn't want to go there with the president. Even today, you know, one Republican said that Mueller should be fired, Louis Gohmert from Texas. You know, and others think this whole thing has been a witch hunt. They've said there should be a special counsel to look into the special counsel. And now even Scalise and McCarthy are into the idea of a special counsel to look into potential FISA abuses. So, you know, the whole thing, it's getting kind of messy. And to think that the president, who has made no bones about how he feels about this investigation, he thinks it's a witch hunt, he said repeatedly, and now has taken to directly attacking Mueller on Twitter, to think that he would sign some kind of a bill like this is really ludicrous.
I want to move on to one more issue. You mentioned on Monday, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, they held a town meeting on inequality in America. Here's a listen to Senator Sanders.
Tonight, we are going to ask some questions and have a discussion with some of the most knowledgeable people in this country on issues that are very, very rarely, if ever, discussed in the corporate media.
And this is interesting because this was kind of a social media thing, getting around that traditional media Senator Sanders just mentioned. What do you make of this, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, it's nothing new from Sanders, and he's very effectively used his mouthpiece to try to bring attention to the issues that that he cares about, which are, inequality, income inequality, the middle class is being decimated, all kinds of issues dealing with poverty. And so, you know, with the mouthpiece that he has and the voice that he has and the fact that he is so popular among progressives and particularly young progressives, you can expect that he and fellow Senator Elizabeth Warren are going to keep up, the drums on those kinds of issues and keep trying to, you know, push their party further towards the left on that kind of stuff. And when they take the majority, that's going to be a big deal to see whether they heed the call and try to pass some kind of legislation that conforms to those kinds of ideals.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you.
We've been talking to Daniel Neuhauser, staff correspondent for the National Journal. He joined us to look at some of the week's top stories in national politics. Food share benefits in Wisconsin, popularly known as food stamps, have been a hot topic in the state capitol this year. As part of a special session on public assistance, the legislature passed 9 of 10 measures proposed by Governor Walker. Some of the changes to food share that made it to Walker's desk include raising the program's work requirement, drug testing, and an asset limit for people receiving food stamps. David Lee is the executive director for Feeding Wisconsin, a network of food banks around the state. He's with us to take a closer look at food share benefits. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Governor Walker said in introducing all of this that he wants to see the food share program and public assistance in general function like a trampoline and not a hammock. And that's reflective of a long-term concern that people grow dependent on something like food assistance and there's a disincentive to move away from it. What do you think about that line of thinking when it comes to food assistance?
Well, I think for the vast majority of people, when you look at the data, SNAP or food share is a trampoline. It provides the grocery buying benefits that people need to have the food they need in order to work, learn, and live healthy lives. I mean, I think what's really interesting about a lot of this rhetoric is people are not talking about the success of food share as a hunger fighting program, because those successes are unassailable. But rather, they're trying to talk about its failure as a jobs program, which it is not, right? It is a nutrition program aimed at connecting people to nutrition benefits so that they can have, you know, a very basic package of benefits that they can spend at the grocery store to get food in order to work, learn, and play.
And some of the changes we mentioned include raising the work requirements for people, some people receiving food share. This is mainly adults who don't have children who are receiving food share benefits, raising required hours from 20 to 30 per week for either working or getting job training. Can you talk about the impact of these required work limits?
Sure. So in 2015, the state re-implemented a work requirement for single adults without children, known the term of art as able-bodied adults without dependents. And that required single adults, again, without children to work or participate in job training for about 20 hours, a week in order to continue to be eligible for food share benefits. Since that work requirement was re-implemented, about 85,000 people lost benefits due to, you know, maybe they didn't want to participate in the job training program, or they couldn't find enough hours for work, or as some of the data has shown, they just weren't notified properly, or they were hard to get in contact with. I mean, I think one of the things about this population of single adults without children is that they are some of the hardest folks to reach with benefits, right? So there's that portion of the work requirement. In the special session bills, one of them would increase the work hours up to 30. So that would mean that if you're already working 20 hours a week, you would have to find an extra 10 hours of work hours or participate in 10 extra hours of job training. And I got to tell you, you know, we run a food share outreach program in our shop, and a lot of the folks that we talk to are working. They're working 20, 25 hours a week. They just can't find those remaining hours in their area, or they're not available from their employer or whatnot. And I feel like a lot of those folks might be caught in a real jam, right? And I think this is also particularly troubling for families with children. A lot of the folks that we've helped have children, and they're working, you know, like I said, somewhere below 30 hours a week, and getting that extra last 2 or 3 hours may not be available from their employer. And also then taking the extra time to go participate in a job training program that may or may not help them feels like it could be a really big lift for them.
Were there success stories maybe related to the work requirements in the past where people left food share because they upped their work hours, got a job, and were able to buy their own food?
Yeah, so, you know, the work requirement since 2015 connected about 25,000 people to jobs. When you dive into the data, it showed that they were working an average of about 33 hours a week and making an average wage of $12 or $13, which is above the state minimum wage. You know, for those 25,000 people, I think that's really great. And we hope that they continue on and are able to parlay these jobs into something a lot more permanent. But, you know, I would note that making $12 to $13 an hour at 30 hours a week is still somewhere on the order of $22,000 a year before taxes. So, you know, it's not like these jobs are, you know, creating a new middle class, right? I mean, the folks even coming in through this work requirement are still working jobs that they still might otherwise qualify for food share.
Talking to David Lee with Feeding Wisconsin. He's executive director there. It's a statewide network of food banks looking at food assistance in Wisconsin and some recent changes. And David, it seems like people across the political spectrum do think there's a common goal, getting people to be as self-sufficient as possible when that's possible. From where you're sitting with Feeding Wisconsin, what's the best way for someone who's receiving food aid now to get from there to being employed and being able to afford food comfortably?
I think that's a really complex question, right? If I had that answer, I don't know that I would be in this position. You know, I think we've always said that a good job is the best anti-hunger tool. A good paying job with good health care, stable housing is the greatest hunger fighting and the greatest anti-poverty tool. What we do know, though, is that in today's, you know, dynamic world and quickly changing environment, sometimes people may be caught in a position where they may not have access to that good job, or those jobs may have left their community, and yet they're still tied to those communities because, you know, that's where they've lived and that's where their families are. And so I think having a one size fits all policy solution as it relates to requiring people to work for food share benefits doesn't actually address many of the real world concerns that people have and the real world challenges that people have on a day-to-day basis as it relates to getting access to those good jobs or the skills to attain those good jobs that are clearly out there, right? I mean, we are in a state where we're near full employment, right? We're at or near 4% or under 4% unemployment. It feels like by increasing the requirements for work, particularly for communities that might experience very high challenges to get those jobs. I think that's that feels tough for us.
I want to bring on a caller now. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. So here's my question. I do not have to take advantage of any kind of food stamps or anything like that, thankfully, but I am a part-time worker. And every time I approach my supervisor to work more than 29 hours a week, the response I get is, we can't let you work more than 29 hours a week because of the Affordable Care Act, which is another way of saying we don't want to give you benefits, so we're going to keep you under 29 hours a week. So doesn't this requirement to have people work more than have them work 30 hours per week, doesn't that come in conflict with the Affordable Care Act? Aren't those two going to, you know, preclude some people from, people are going to have to make a choice between health care and employment?
Laura, thanks for the call. David, is moving from 29 to 30 a tough obstacle?
I would say that for some employers, given that for some employers, it definitely does raise costs per employee. And I think, you know, as we think about the benefits that come with having a full-time job, which, you know, include good some sort of health care and some of the other ancillary benefits that come with that, it certainly does strike me that. For some employers, that may be a challenge. And I think that's also where we sort of come at this, right? That, like, there might be a lot of folks like the caller just now who are working and are kept artificially low on hours because getting them past a certain point would create higher costs. So that's why we feel that this 30-hour this new 30-hour requirement could be a real challenge for many folks due to no fault of their own, right? They want those hours, they're just not available, or they can't get them.
David, I wanted to ask you about another change, the asset limit. We're saying you can't get food assistance if you have a car over a certain value or a house over a certain value. Can you talk about how that would work and what you think about it?
Yeah, so the asset limit would create an asset test, and which means that you would have to prove that you don't have a car that's worth over $20,000 or a house worth more than, I think, two times the median home value in Wisconsin. So that's somewhere on the order of, so for cars, it's $20,000, and for homes, I think it's somewhere on the order of $300,000. Here's the thing. For the vast majority of people on food share, for all of them, they don't have any assets, right? They have an average of $333 in the bank. So for them, this will become another bureaucratic red tape for them to have to cross in order to get benefits. And that's a challenge and a barrier for entry. I think the talking point is that we're trying to keep the lottery winners out of this program. The sheer fact of it is that there aren't any lottery winners in the program. And if there are, the OIG, the Office of Inspector General, has found them and has rooted them out, because the fraud detection protocols in the food share program is extremely high, right? We are at a fraud rate in the SNAP program of somewhere on the order of 1.5%. And I think it's really important to hold on this for a second, because if you had any private industry coming on this show talking about their loss rate at 1.5%, I think we'd be pretty happy about that. This is really, I think, this could actually, I think, if you really think about it, unintentionally ensnare folks who've worked hard and played by the rules their whole lives and have maybe found some job dislocation due to no fault of their own, and suddenly are caught in this weird choice of you know, maybe having a nice car that they'd bought with a job previous, and suddenly they would have to, like, sell their car in order to qualify for nutrition assistance benefits, just to bridge them through a tough time in their life. And I don't know that is how we should be writing policy.
We'll leave it there for now. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's David Lee, Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. He joined us for a look at the state's food share program and the path to self-sufficiency. The suspect behind a series of package bombs that exploded in and around Austin, Texas, is dead. 23-year-old Mark Anthony Condit detonated a bomb in his car early this morning as law enforcement tried to apprehend him. His death marks the end of a three-week-long manhunt, but police are still warning residents in the Austin area to be careful if they see suspicious packages. Here's Austin's interim police chief, Brian Manley, earlier this morning.
This is the culmination of three very long weeks for our community. And throughout these weeks, we've talked about the importance of remaining vigilant and looking out for each other. I want to continue that message as we stand here this morning, though, because we don't know where this suspect has spent his last 24 hours, and therefore we still need to remain vigilant to ensure that no other packages or devices have been left through the community.
Ben Philpott is the senior editor for KUT in Austin. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Hello.
Before we get to the latest, Ben, can you talk about what it's been like for people living in the Austin area with the uncertainty surrounding these bombs?
Well, you know, people have definitely been scared, and it has been, you know, top of mind for families in the area, but people have not changed what they're doing. People have not stopped going to work. They have not stopped shopping or going out to dinner. But it is absolutely something that people have, you can't not know about it and not be thinking about it as you're walking around.
What do we know about the perpetrator at this point?
Not a whole lot. There's a little bit of information that's been coming out. We believe he was homeschooled, had attended a local community college here, but did not finish. Did work for a tech company, although not in, you know, the tech part of it. I think he did stuff with shipping and so not the tech side. We know that his family was a member of a church here in Austin, and that he grew up with a religious background. But that's about it at the moment.
Yeah, if anybody is out there at this point saying anything about his motives, his motivations, it's probably pure speculation at this point, right?
In terms of official word, yes. I mean, people may be, you know, quoting sources unnamed, but as far as what we're getting officially from the FBI or the Austin Police Department, there is not a motive yet.
Can you talk, Ben, about what we've heard from the police in the Austin area and the FBI about how they managed to track him down and trace where these bombs were coming from?
Yeah, they had been able to, try and search for what kind of different things that, you know, might be used in a bomb, what purchasers are being made around town. But it seems like the real big break came when they were able to trace back two packages that were sent through FedEx. One of those, of course, exploded in a FedEx facility in a town just north of San Antonio. It had been mailed from Austin, but had ended up there. A second package had gone to a FedEx facility in another part of Austin and was contained there without exploding. From there, they were able to figure out, they had footage of the person. They had other information that he gave, to mail these packages. And it seems like that really sped up what police were working on.
And one of the puzzling things and disturbing things in some ways was these bombs, there were a number of different methods used to deliver them, right?
Yeah, that was one of the interesting things. The first three were all placed on, the front doorstep of families in East Austin, which is a historically minority part of town. All three of the homes that the bombs were placed at were owned by minority families, two African-American families and a Hispanic family. So there was initially an idea that this was possibly a hate crime, somebody targeting minorities in Austin. But then the fourth bomb was just set on the side of a street with a tripwire, so that whoever happened to walk by, it would go off. And then the fifth one, the final one that actually exploded, was one of the two that were sent through official mail through FedEx. So that had everyone kind of wondering, well, what might be the next evolution of what this person was doing.
Talking to Ben Philpott, senior editor for KUT in Austin, about the recent wave of bombings there. The suspect now dead after an explosion while police were trying to apprehend him. Ben, can you talk some about the victims, people killed or injured in these attacks?
Yeah, we've got two people that have been killed. The first one back on March 2nd was Anthony Stephen House, 39-year-old. He had a daughter, an 8-year-old daughter, and lived in the area for a while. Also on then March 12th, the second bombing was killed Draylen Mason, a 17-year-old who was a very accomplished double bass player and had actually already been accepted into the music school at the University of Texas at Austin.
And what happens next now in this investigation?
You know, as the clip you played early said, right now initially they were just trying to make sure that there weren't other things put through the mail, that there weren't other bombs set around Austin by this man. And so they've, you know, here on the University of Texas campus, they had been saying for a couple of days, if you see something, say something. Well, this morning after the suspect was killed, the president put out a statement that just said, you know what, we're not going to wait for that anymore. And all of a sudden you saw bomb sniffing dogs going around campus, checking out the campus to make sure that maybe he had not placed one here before he had died up north of Austin. So so that was, I think, kind of the first thing that the agents were looking for. But now it is, you know, they have been going through the house that he was staying in the town of Pflugerville, just north of Austin. They've been going over everything in that house. They had cleared out the area around the house. Obviously, you have a suspected bomber. You would suspect there might be additional bombing products there in the house, and so they cleared out parts of the neighborhood to you know, just in case something went off. But you know, they're just trying to piece together motive. They're trying to piece together whether or not other people were helping him. He did stay with he had a couple of roommates, and the last message that the Austin Police Department put out about that is that they had questioned both of them. One of them had been questioned and released. The other one was being questioned and had not been released at the time. That was a couple hours ago, but that's the last note I got on that. So, yeah, they want to make sure that there aren't other people involved and that there aren't other bombs already out there and there aren't other bombs that someone else could be making.
And on a side note, Ben, there was one explosion while all this was going on at a Goodwill that it turned out to have nothing to do with this particular perpetrator.
Yeah, and I was at that one actually last night. You know, the town, like we talked about at the beginning, the town being on edge when something like this happens, and you have all the FBI and alcohol, tobacco, and firearm agents in town ready to assist. It shut down the entire intersection around that Goodwill. But yes, that was just actually it appears to be either an old military ordnance or possibly a military ordnance simulator, you know, a blank, something that they might use in training for how to shoot a gun or shoot whatever the weapon was that had this ordnance in it. So it was loud enough and strong enough to hurt the person at the Goodwill who handled it, but not seriously injure that person. And yeah, was not connected to anything else that was going on.
Well, Ben, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us today. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Been talking to Ben Philpott. He's a senior editor for KUT in Austin, public radio there, our colleagues. He joined us with the latest on the series of bombings in and around Austin, the long-term story. Story still developing as police continue their investigation, but the alleged suspect died this morning in a confrontation with police after setting off one more explosive. That's Kenny Loggins with Footloose from the movie of the same name. And that song's being preserved for music history along with 24 other recordings. The National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress picks 25 recordings each year for special preservation. They're up to over 500 now, I think. The selections are all designated as being, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, end quote, recordings. So there are albums being added this year, including Fleetwood Mac's Rumors album and Run DMC's Raising Hell, and songs including My Girl by The Temptations and The Gambler by Kenny Rogers. And there are historically significant selections, like a rare 1928 recording of the Sioux's Yanktoni Dakota Band and a comedy album by Groucho Marx. Sometime over the next week or two, we're going to ask for you to suggest your recordings that you think should be preserved, that are of special significance to the country or maybe just to you. And we'll go out to the news now with another selection by Chic. This is Central Time.
One, two, three.